Flyover Politic Podcast, the show for normal Americans. From this undisclosed bunker, here's your host, Tony Reid.
That Netanyahu should go!
I better not start the questions. I'll get in trouble.
What's your message for Super Tuesday voters?
Everyone, please move this way.
Super Tuesday, say, do you have a message for voters?
Thanks, come on.
Thank you so much. Thank you all.
And welcome back to Flyover Politic Podcast. It is the 17th of March, year of our Lord, 2024. I was going to be doing an old dude music one, but the wife is not feeling well and watching TV. And I said, well, what the hell? Let's do a podcast. Never really covered half the material I had from last one, because that's our commander-in-chief. What the fucking fuck? What the fuck, man? Come on. It hurts my pancreas. I don't know where my pancreas is, but it hurts that that's our commander-in-chief. That dude right there is our commander-in-chief. He is a total clusterfuck. I mean, just a fucking clusterfuck, folks. What the fuck was that? What the fuck is that? This guy is not functional. He's just not a functional human being. Yet we're told that's the savior of democracy if you don't vote for that guy. I mean, did you look at his eyes? He's the only time he's sentient is when they jack him up with drugs. And if anybody thinks that's bullshit, it's not bullshit. The dude is on drugs. You know he is. We all know he is. It's clearly obvious. They put him on speed or something. But you're not going to hear that. You hear that the previous administration was all on the speed. It was rolling in speed. They had so much speed. Always speed. They're taking speed, 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 speed. That's what we always heard about the previous administration. But there's a definite difference between him when he's on some kind of substance and him when he's not on that substance. Because Holmes Skillet at times literally looks like he is not mentally awake, like he's fallen asleep. That face, I remember getting that face. I'd have that face in the army when I didn't sleep for fucking year or a couple days. You know, I'd have that look that he has. But the whole pulling him away from asking questions, how long are we going to allow that? I mean, are we going to always just have this guy in a basement? So to follow up a few things before we get into our main subject for today, which is going to be Gaza and Schumer. No shame, TikTok openly brags about U.S. influence despite ban. They're just talking shit. And because I used to love this guy, and it really hurts my feelings the way he's ended up. Here's Crenshaw, something about Tucker Carlson. I got comments on.
Access to everything TikTok has, which means data on all Americans. And with data and with access to your, you know, app that you're addicted to, you can vastly manipulate an entire population, which the Chinese have done.
Already. Are you worried that our intelligence agencies are doing the same thing domestically?
Am I worried that? I know that they're not.
They're not manipulating Americans? They're not controlling the flow of information?
Yeah, did you have some evidence otherwise that you'd like to share?
I mean,
okay.
Before that's the
20th. Any serious questions?
Some ByteDance were to say
Congressman, you asked for an example of the U.S. intelligence agencies meddling in our information. What about before the 2020 election when 50 members came out and said the Hunter Biden laptop was Russian disinformation? Does that count?
No, because, I mean, they were retired.
They were retired, but the FBI had the laptop for over a year.
There's nothing even close to what TikTok.
Oh, my God. You know, I'm not a Republican. I'm not a Democrat, but God damn, Republicans are fucking stupid. Bitter former Tea Partier Joe Walsh can't keep Trump's name out of his mouth. This is like he did an interview and he goes, if Trump constantly be a victim, he'd just wither away and die. He was under investigation by Obama. That should have never happened. We look like a banana republic. It's all true, though. He's not a victim. You have to stand up for yourself and call out lies, specifically propaganda news media. He has been harassed, vilified, and persecuted. That's just a fact. And, you know, once again, I think he's an idiot. But what's happened to Trump is criminal. I mean, it's just criminal. It never stops. They've been going after this guy since 2016. What they don't realize is the same reason why Bush W. won. He won because you guys kept going after him. And eventually people were like, I feel sorry for the guy. He won the competition of who are you going to have a beer with? It was Bush, not Kerry. CNN attempts a dirty job on Mike Rowe, and he definitely handles the sneaky scheme.
Well, he's very gracious. And he's very smart, and he's very direct. And I had no idea what I was really walking into, but his team was there, and they were also super inquisitive. They listened more than they talked. I wound up interviewing him. He interviewed me. We had a few laughs. It was a very friendly, very casual conversation, but he's serious. And when he talks about the things he's serious about, he leans in, and it's hard not to listen. He's serious about the debt. He doesn't want to see $34 trillion get to 50. He believes if it does, the country can't service it. Party's over. He's serious about ending forever wars. He's serious about waging a war, really, on chronic disease and diabetes and things like that. We don't agree on everything, that's for sure. And when that became apparent, he just laughed and said, look, I don't want to surround myself with yes men and yes women. I want people who care about the country. I want people who will tell me the truth as they see it and let the chips fall. You said a lot of stuff that was good to hear, frankly.
So when you talk about things you didn't agree with him on, I mean, is there anything you can be specific on? And did he bring up things that, as you know, Mike, have been controversial? You talk about his care for health, for example. Vaccines. I mean, did topics like that come up directly?
Not really, because that stuff has been so talked to death in the media that everybody kind of knows, all right, this is the rap. Is there anything you want to say about it specifically? Honestly, Aaron, yeah, we did talk about some of that stuff, and I don't know that it's fair for me to really walk you through it chapter and verse. I told him, for instance, look, I'm friendly with a lot of people in the fossil fuel business. That's not a secret. My foundation is supported by all sorts of people who he's sued in the past. We laughed about that and just kept coming back to, look, we're living in an extraordinary time. The headlines have never been like this. The things that we seem to agree on, we appear to agree on with a certain amount of passion. And then it just became personal, to tell you the truth. Look, I've been doing this foundation for 16 years. At base, it's a PR campaign. At base, it's an attempt to raise awareness around a couple of things that matter to me a lot. And he was very upfront about it. He said, look, Mike, that topic, education, middle class, vocational development and workforce and so forth, that's the pointy part of the spear in my campaign. It matters. And if you want to see your foundation go from micro works to macro works, I think he said, then you should think about this. You should at least consider it. And so I did.
And consider it, you mean consider the VP slot?
Sure.
So I want to ask you one thing here. As you talk about the seriousness with which RFK Jr. is taking the decision that he has to make and his campaign and the people around him. On his list, you mentioned a sports star. That, of course, is the NFL quarterback Aaron Rodgers. And I don't know if you know this, but Rodgers told two people, and one of those people is CNN's Pamela Brown. He told them about conspiracy theories about the 2012 shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary, including saying the shooting was a government inside job, that victims' families were crisis actors. Do you believe that that is a serious point of view? Is that somebody that should be on a Kennedy ticket?
I have no idea. I think that I think he has a right to articulate whatever he wants, and we have a right to respond however we want. I have no idea what the man actually said. I did see something about it today, but I don't know what qualifies or disqualifies anybody from running for anything. You know, somebody said to me the other day, a friend of mine who saw the same graphic that you put up earlier, I think her exact question was, how the hell are you qualified to do this? And I started to explain how she was right and how I wasn't. And, you know, Bobby said something to me. He said, there's so many skeletons in my closet. If you really open it up and give it a look, and if they could all vote, I'd be king of the world, which made me laugh. You could probably find stupid stuff that anybody has said. But what really qualifies a man or woman to run for president or vice president? I think you got to be 35. I think you need to have been born in this country. After that, I don't know about qualifications. I guess we could talk experience and judgment and temperament and all of those other things, and everybody gets to weigh and measure everybody and put it all under a microscope and decide. Personally, I stopped watching football after the Colts left Baltimore, so I don't know how much use I can be on that.
Oh, wow. Wouldn't even think we'd have a Baltimore connection like that. All right. Thank
you
so much.
They broke my heart, Aaron. They broke my heart.
As a Marylander, I hear you. All right. Thank you so much. I appreciate your time, Mike, and it's always great to see you.
Stephen Miller, I heard Mike Rose sleeps in a coffin like Dracula and drinks baby blood. Not sure it's true, something I heard 10 years ago, Blake Tapper. I would honestly vote for Roe Works for almost any office he chose. Mike was talking for about 10 seconds and she stopped listening, reloaded for the next question. He could have talked about seven dwarves being rapists and she would have nothing to follow up on. Please, CNN, please start a fight with a guy who literally had a show focused on blue-collar workers. Yeah, do it. The guy's the nicest guy in the world. You're just a bunch of fucking twats. Leave the poor guy alone. CDC, listen to this fucking shit. If this is not good, I don't know what is. The latest development along COVID is going to make you angry. So what the hell did we go through all this for? Expected another wave of either angry or hilarity regarding the new guidelines from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued earlier this month. Treat this viral infection like the fucking flu. Masking is grossly ineffective. The vaccine is no more effective than the seasonal flu shot. You can still get infected, but it might have saved someone a trip to the ICU. That's fine. But the cocktail was marketed as a bulletproof vest against infection. Ivermectin was long dismissed as an effective therapeutic, but it works. What's the next shooter drop? Long COVID? It's a myth, or at least a new Australian study strongly urges we ditched talking about it. The data is clear. Long COVID is devastating people's lives. Time to stop using the term long COVID, as symptoms are no worse than those after the flu. Same fucking media outfit, the longly represented blue, the Garlean. Come on, folks. It's a guy who's still dealing with that shit. I know unequivocally, had I not gotten the vaccine, I wouldn't be still sick. I mean, I'm doing 10 times better. I do take a double dose of Rabisol, the new Prilosec that's supposed to work better. I do take 100 milligrams of nortriptyline every night, and it makes me okay. I still can't eat beef. I still get unknown symptoms. I don't know why I get them. It's just a fucking joke. The punishment for Biden staffers for his misuse of fucking or mishandling of documents will piss you off. But listen, let's listen to Herd really quick.
Make sure you got that mic on if you could, Mr. Herd. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman Jordan, Ranking Member Nadler, Chairman Comer, Ranking Member Raskin, members of the committee, good morning. I'm privileged to have served our country for the majority of my career, a decade and a half, most of those years with the Department of Justice. I have served as a line prosecutor, a supervisor, the Principal Associate Deputy Attorney General, a United States Attorney, and a special counsel. I've served in these roles with gratitude as the son of immigrants to this country, the first member of my family to be born here. My parents grew up in Korea and were young children during the Korean War. My father remembers being hungry and grateful for the food that American GIs shared with him and his siblings. My mother fled what is now North Korea in her own mother's arms, heading south to safety. My parents eventually met, married, and came to the U.S., seeking a better life for themselves and for their children. Their lives and mine would have been very different were it not for this country. No matter the role, no matter the administration, I have applied the same standards and the same impartiality. My respect for the Justice Department and my commitment to this country are why I agreed to serve as special counsel when asked by the Attorney General. I resolved to do the work as I did all my work for the department, fairly, thoroughly, and professionally, with close attention to the policies and practices that govern department prosecutors. My team and I conducted a thorough, independent investigation. We identified evidence that the president willfully retained classified materials after the end of his vice presidency when he was a private citizen. This evidence included an audio-recorded conversation during which Mr. Biden told his ghostwriter that he had, quote, just found all the classified stuff downstairs, end quote. When Mr. Biden said this, he was a private citizen speaking to his ghostwriter in his private rental home in Virginia. We also identified other recorded conversations during which Mr. Biden read classified information aloud to his ghostwriter. We did not, however, identify evidence that rose to the level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Because the evidence fell short of that standard, I declined to recommend criminal charges against Mr. Biden. The department's regulations required me to write a confidential report explaining my decision to the Attorney General. I understood that my explanation about this case had to include rigorous, detailed, and thorough analysis. In other words, I needed to show my work, just as I would expect any prosecutor to show his or her work explaining the decision to prosecute or not. The need to show my work was especially strong here. The Attorney General had appointed me to investigate the actions of the Attorney General's boss, the sitting President of the United States. I knew that for my decision to be credible, I could not simply announce that I recommended no criminal charges and leave it at that. I needed to explain why. My report reflects my best effort to explain why I declined to recommend charging President Biden. I analyzed the evidence as prosecutors routinely do, by assessing its strengths and weaknesses, including by anticipating the ways in which the president's defense lawyers might poke holes in the government's case, if there were a trial, and seek to persuade jurors that the government could not prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There has been a lot of attention paid to language in the report about the president's memory, so let me say a few words about that. My task was to determine whether the president retained or disclosed national defense information willfully. That means knowingly and with the intent to do something the law forbids. I could not make that determination without assessing the president's state of mind. For that reason, I had to consider the president's memory and overall mental state and how a jury likely would perceive his memory and mental state in a criminal trial. These are the types of issues that prosecutors analyze every day. And because these issues were important to my ultimate decision, I had to include a discussion of them in my report to the Attorney General. The evidence and the president himself put his memory squarely at issue. We interviewed the president and asked him about his recorded statement, quote, "I just found all the classified stuff downstairs," end quote. He told us that he didn't remember saying that to his ghostwriter. He also said he didn't remember finding any classified material in his home after his vice presidency. And he didn't remember anything about how classified documents about Afghanistan made their way into his garage. My assessment in the report about the relevance of the president's memory was necessary and accurate and fair. Most importantly, what I wrote is what I believe the evidence shows and what I expect jurors would perceive and believe. I did not sanitize my explanation, nor did I disparage the president unfairly. I explained to the Attorney General my decision and the reasons for it. That's what I was required to do. I took the same approach when I compared the evidence regarding President Biden to the department's allegations against former President Trump. There, too, I called it like I saw it. As a prosecutor, I had to consider relevant precedents and to explain why different facts justify different outcomes. That is what I did in my report. I'm confident the analysis set forth in chapters 11, 12, and 13 of my report provides a thorough evaluation and explanation of the evidence, and I encourage everyone to read it to inform their opinions of the report. Prosecutors rarely write public reports or testify about their investigations. That is the Justice Department's longstanding policy, and it protects important interests. My team and I prepared the report to the Attorney General with care, and the report stands as the primary source of information. My responses today will be limited to clarifying information for the committee. I will refrain from speculating or commenting on areas outside the scope of the investigation, nor will I discuss what investigative steps we did or did not take beyond what's in the report. In conclusion, I want to express my heartfelt thanks to the attorneys, agents, analysts, and professional staff who helped us do our work fairly, thoroughly, and independently. I am grateful and privileged to have served with them. I single out for particular thanks Deputy Special Counsel Mark Crickbaum, a former United States attorney himself, who brought great wisdom, skill, and judgment to our task. Thank you. I welcome your questions.
Thank you.
Top aides of President Biden involved in the mishandling of classified documents were given plump promotions within 24 hours of release of Special Counsel Herr's damning report, the Post has learned. Annie Thomason, a Biden staffer since his Senate days, was named Deputy White House Chief of Staff on February 8th. The next day, Richard Roofner moved into Thomason's old gig as Director of the Oval Office. So, once again, Trump people go to fucking jail. Democrats... this is always how it was. You go back to Obama's time frame, and Obama and company, literally, what happened to the learner lady who was caught fucking around in the IRS? She got a promotion, retired, nothing happened. It's the way it is. AP, breaking, a white Connecticut state trooper was acquitted of manslaughter in 2020. Death of a black community college student was shot after a high-speed chase. 19-year-old community college was shot. He sat behind the wheel of a stolen car holding a kitchen knife and apparently in the throes of a mental health crisis. Trooper Brian North, 33, could have faced up to 40 years in prison if he had been convicted of the first-degree manslaughter in the January 15, 2020 shooting. The state inspector general said the shooting shouldn't have happened because North and other officers were not in imminent danger. But the six-person jury in Milford acquitted him. Nor showed little emotion as the verdict was read. Afterward, he shook hands with a lawyer and hugged the head of the state police. Nor didn't comment while leaving court, but his lead attorney said the trooper is still shaken by the shooting. Why is the race being specified? Because that's what it's always about. A non-white. Supreme Court this week pissed off the left because he wouldn't do anything about anything, let the lower courts handle stuff. And it was unanimous. But they never say that. They always say something else. Do some state senators threaten riot after pro-police bill passed? State Senator Brent Taylor, a tough on-crime Republican, introduced the bill after the Memphis City Council ordered police to no longer pull over motorists. Cars with expired registration within 60 days of expiration, when a temporary registration permit is properly located, when the registration plate is not securely fastened, when a single brake or headlight is operable, cars with a loose bumper. Gloves off. Senator Charlene Oliver from Nashville calls for riots after Tennessee Senate passed the Senator Brent Taylor pro-police bill. It is rooted in racism. The next one is another African-American woman who says something else is attuned to slavery.
What we see here is drunk on power. I don't like that you take this position on this bill, so I'm going to silence you. That's a form of slavery. I feel like a slave sometime in this building. I'm over it. And all of the members standing here are over it. At what point are we going to truly be a democratic body, respect the fact that every single one of us are represented by the same amount of people in their districts, and we all deserve the same voice and the same level of respect, regardless if we agree or not. I am tired of the Republican Party expecting us as minorities to do what they want to do, but treat us disrespectfully. Nah, we're not doing that no more. As we at this time of session wearing gloves off. And I support any of my members have the right to defend themselves, to not accept disrespect, and we shouldn't expect disrespect from the other side of the aisle. I just wanted to get it off my chest. Y'all heard it, you can repeat it, but it had to be said. Senator Oliver, it is a slap in the face, and you might as well stomp on the grave of Tyre Nichols for bringing this bill. Yes, we are emotionally charged. Why? Because it's personal for us. Taylor made this personal the minute he introduced this legislation to target one family and one life that was lost. So yeah, we're gonna fight. Dr. King said the riots are the language of the unheard. You ain't seen nothing yet. If you keep silencing us like this, what do you think our district's gonna do? We have had it up here. Gloves off. Like, we're going to fight like hell. You don't expect us to respond when you gaslight us every single day with these bills? There's a bill to get rid of the Tennessee Human Rights Commission that they're going to bring, to abolish it, rooted in the Civil Rights Act, to make sure that we have protections for folks that look like Tyre Nichols. Don't tell me this stuff ain't racist. Don't tell me it's not. It is rooted in racism. This was a Jim Crow bill that Taylor brought, and all his Confederates voted for it today.
You know, we've had whole elections ran on the concept that...
Awesome!
Sorry, I pushed the wrong one. A conservative person saying a comment have been whole elections. But yet, we don't do anything for the left. None. NBC News. Elon Musk and conservative influencers have spread unverified claims to millions smearing Haitian immigrants as cannibals as they endure deep uncertainty about the future of their country and family members still here. Rolling Stones. Right-wingers are pushing an absurd lie about Haitian cannibal invasion. Somebody asked, Rolling Stones, is there any music you could cover? Literally, there is video of them eating people. It's literally unavailability. Sharing videos from Haiti is now checks notes, an absurd lie. You should go there and find out. Please go there and disprove the claim and get eaten. See, it's always got to be little itty-bitty bullshit. That's how we roll. So, the big thing is Gaza. And once again, we have a problem in America in regards to our media literally allowing one side to seriously meddle in elections. I mean, Obama to Biden, they've never stopped meddling in our election. Here was his notes again. If we zoom in, we can see that the man can't speak. He has to have a cheat sheet for fucking everything. And he was taken away, but I'm going to play Schumer and Biden's comments about what Schumer said about Netanyahu, an elected official from another country.
I believe a new election is the only way to allow for a healthy and open decision-making process about the future of Israel. Of course, the United States cannot dictate the outcome of an election, nor should we try. That is for the Israeli public to decide.
Do you have any comments, sir, on Senator Schumer's speech on Israel yesterday?
Senator Schumer contacted my staff, my senior staff, who's going to make that speech, and I'm not going to elaborate on the speech. He made a good speech, and I think he expressed a serious concern shared not only by him but by many Americans.
How is this proper? We had a president say other countries are shitholes, and it became the biggest thing we talked about forever. Now, Schumer literally tries to interfere with a foreign election, and we say nothing. Why does the press continue to shout out in unison knowing that he's not going to answer anybody? I don't know. None of it makes fucking sense. None of this stuff makes sense. We literally have a broken system right now, folks. It is so fucking bad. How is that okay? Then he does this, because once again, he needs Michigan, and Dearborn is full of Obama-infused Islamists. On International Day to Combat Islamophobia, we recognize the hate the Muslims face because of their beliefs and the ugly resurgence of Islamophobia following the war in Gaza. Let us redirect ourselves to a world where people of all faiths are free to live without fear. Joe Biden defends every religion except Christianity. Christians are the most persecuted people in the world, and yet Biden says nothing. That's because he doesn't believe in Christian values. Biden supports abortion up to moment of birth. That's barbaric and immoral. Anything to say about Islamists murdering African Christians? Is it too late to ponder the Muslims, Joe? They aren't voting for you in November. So Islamists have been killing Christians, Jews, and infidels over millennia just to exist, just for existing, and continues to this day. But somehow we need to recognize and combat some non-existent surge of Islamophobia. Stop pandering to the mosque wing of your party. It's disgusting. Reported for disinformation. It's wrong. It's completely wrong. But the media was all for it, and this is my soapbox.
And this is the largest number of children killed in all of the wars that are taking place across the globe combined at this point. I mean, the number of dead Palestinian children is so breathtaking. The UN can barely believe it. But the other thing I think that's happened is that it feels to me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, as if Benjamin Netanyahu has done more than any other Israeli prime minister to politicize Israel and politicize support for Israel. Not that either both parties, Democrats and Republicans, don't support Israel, but he's made it very political. You saw Republicans come out and say one thing and Democrats come out and say another. He's actually kind of made his government sort of an adjunct of the Republican Party, no?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when Mitch McConnell used the words grotesque hypocrisy, which is something he knows about, he was talking about a situation today that is exactly the same as what Netanyahu started to do 9 years ago. Everybody must remember, Netanyahu came to the U.S., addressed the Congress, did so around the Obama administration, threw in with Trump, essentially made himself a MAGA surrogate before Trump and during the Trump administration, and now McConnell is upset that people are politicizing this? This is nonsense, and his already decaying credibility.
And the highest-ranking Jewish elected official in the United States is calling for changes in Israel now 5 months into its war with Hamas. We'll play for you what Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
And my gosh, something. If you heard the reaction from the far right, from the Trump right, you would have forgotten for a second that Benjamin Netanyahu was the guy that let Israel's defenses down, was the guy that knew in 2018 where all of the illicit funding was for the Hamas terror organization, was the guy who gave Hamas money through Qatar, with a couple of weeks left to go, and had the attack plans a year before from Hamas, did absolutely nothing, actually had evidence that morning that what was happening, again, did absolutely nothing. But my God, Benjamin Netanyahu, you'd think he was George Washington. The attacks, just absolutely unbelievable. Benjamin Netanyahu should have resigned the day after, when it took 5, 6, 7, 10 hours to bring aid to children who had seen their parents shot to death in front of their eyes, or babies shot in a crib. I mean, I could go on and on, but seriously, the outrage, the faux outrage is such garbage. It's why Americans hate politics. It really is. There's no doubt Netanyahu has damaged Israel in a way no prime minister has damaged Israel since 1948, and they know it. So, Willie, really, I mean, God, reading some of the editorials, reading some of the tweets, reading some of the garbage from the far right really is nauseating. As somebody who has supported Israel my entire life, guy who's spoken before AIPAC my entire life, my God, I mean, how much do they want to politicize this? Some of us, I know this is radical, some of us actually want what's best for Israel and not what's best for Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump. Some of us actually give a damn about the safety and security of Israel, not just now, but 5 years from now, 50 years from now.
Yeah, all of that is true, but no less an extraordinary moment to hear Chuck Schumer, Democrat, who represents the largest Jewish population in the world outside of Israel, in the state of New York, to say explicitly it's time for a change of leadership. It's something a lot of people have been thinking, as you said, but something we're not accustomed to hearing from a leader, such a high-ranking leader in American politics, that it's time for a change. Leader Schumer did put out a statement later saying, this is up to the people of Israel. This is how I view this. The people of Israel need to decide that. But you're right. There was a huge reaction from the right, a huge reaction from inside Israel, from the Netanyahu government as well. Just a fascinating dynamic here as we see our own president, President Biden, not just Chuck Schumer, stepping up his criticism of Netanyahu and the way he's conducted this war as well.
Well, you know, it's a sad dynamic. It's a sad dynamic because there's some people in America on the far right who are more interested in helping Benjamin Netanyahu than Israel. I mean, I guess that's just the sad reality. I mean, there are a lot of us that are a lot more concerned about the Israeli people and Israel's security and Israel's
the
long-term...
The hostages,
Israel's long-term support.
135 days.
The support, which is just continues to erode in the United States and across the globe. So there are some of us that have always supported Israel that, yeah, we're concerned about what's going on, more than a little concerned about what's going on in Israel. What went on October 7th, what's been going on college campuses across this country, the anti-Semitism that's been sweeping the world now for, 2,000 years or so. So, but again, this is a disastrous path that Netanyahu's on, and they know. The far-right extremists who are defending Netanyahu right now know. He's doing everything he can do to stay in office. It's not for the...
Jonathan, you interviewed the president last week. You asked him about his red lines. Has a red line with Netanyahu now been crossed?
I think so. If you take Majority Leader Schumer's incredible speech, put that on top of what the president told me last week, which was, yes, if Netanyahu crosses over into Rafah, that would be a red line for him. Add that on top of the now very vocal opposition to Netanyahu that's been coming from the administration, from the Secretary of State and other senior officials in the administration, we are seeing a widening break, not between the United States and Israel, but between the United States and Prime Minister Netanyahu, who the Biden administration from the president on down view as an obstacle, not just to peace, but to some sort of resolution to what's happening in the Israel-Hamas war, but especially a resolution to the humanitarian crisis that's happening in Gaza.
David, how big a shift is this in the U.S. approach?
For Chuck Schumer, it's pretty vague. He's very pro-Israel. And so I do think it's a big shift. I agree with everything he said about Bibi Netanyahu. I still think he shouldn't have said it. He shouldn't have certainly have said it that way. A, it's just not becoming to try to interfere in another democracy's electoral process, especially if you're a major figure in the American election. Second, I worry about how it's being received by Hamas. So Hamas's strategy is to get as many Palestinians killed as possible, and hoping that the ensuing outrage is going to cause the international community to crack down on Israel, and Israel will have to relent. And they see Chuck Schumer doing that, and they think, which they already think, which is they're winning. And frankly, when they see what President Biden told to Jonathan about the red line, it was a little fuzzy the way he said it. Was he against a Rafah invasion, or only if the Israelis don't really improve their humanitarian record? But if he's against a Rafah, any kind of incursion into Rafah, as Benny Gantz, the defense secretary of Israel, said, when you're fighting a fire, you can't only fight 80% of the fire. And the hostages and a significant chunk of Hamas forces are in Rafah. And if you let them win, if you let them stay there, there will never be a two-state solution, because there will never be a two-state solution as long as Hamas is in power. And so I mostly worry about the...
Well, you mentioned what Senator Schumer said, the Senate Majority Leader, calling for new elections in Israel. Would that make a difference to you? Do you think it would make a difference who leads Israel in the type of war that would be prosecuted? And how much of a difference does that make to you that he specifically is calling for that?
You know, we have been sounding alarm about Benjamin Netanyahu for over two decades, knowing that he is a fascist and a war tyrant and a war criminal. And he has been one of the individuals who gloats about being able to stall peace and prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state. So certainly it makes a difference with who leads the Israeli government. But what's important is that while the elections could be called for, elections can go into process, that doesn't change what's happening on the ground today. This is why it's extremely important for President Biden to utilize the leverage that he currently has and restrict military aid and being forceful in his calls not for a temporary ceasefire, but a permanent and lasting ceasefire immediately. Those are the things that we're looking for from our president, because that can make the difference today. Each morning we wake up and what we find is a kill count. How many innocent men, women, and children had been killed by the Israeli government, by the IDF, utilizing American manufactured weapons? And we need to halt that immediately.
And of course, we're watching starvation as well happen, and there's a lot of groups who are sounding the alarm about what should be coming here in the coming weeks. We've just started to see this, and it's expected to balloon if the aid doesn't increase dramatically. So, Mayor, you have a group of Palestinian Arab and Muslim American activists. They declined to meet with senior White House officials in the Chicago area today. They said in a letter this morning to the White House, there's no point in more meetings. The White House already knows the position of the aforementioned groups and our allies across the nation. I wonder what you think this means for the general election. Is this a sign that Biden cannot mend this break with Muslim and Arab Americans in the U.S., or do you think...
And I do want to talk to you about where there's confusion. There is confusion, I think, a little bit about the administration stance on a ceasefire. We heard from Vice President Kamala Harris, who came out very forcefully and publicly saying an immediate ceasefire needs to happen right now.
Within 6 weeks. Yes. 6 weeks.
But she used the words immediate ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And we haven't heard the same exact thing publicly from President Biden. So why? Why isn't the messaging the same from the two of them?
Well, I mean, I listened to Vice President Harris's speech. What she said was, she used the term immediate, but she also said for 6 weeks. They are consistently for a temporary pause in the fighting to ensure, and this is essential, that the hostages can be released, that we can make sure that a threat that exists to Israel from an entity that is sworn to its destruction can be eradicated, and that we can make sure that there's a negotiation for a longer term, a longer term ceasefire. But there's no country on earth that should be expected to live with a terrorist threat on their border, an entity like Hamas that is sworn to Israel's destruction, sworn to the eradication of the Jewish people, and is still holding 133 hostages, including 5 Americans and several remains of Americans that need to be released now.
There is, of course, a lot of pushback there, and we heard this actually from Joe Biden, is just the numbers of people killed, the numbers of Palestinians killed, and the devastation that they're seeing, and what's going to happen in the end. And I do want to show you some numbers that came out that were startling, disturbing. It's the number of children that were killed, and there's this graph here, the children killed in conflicts, and the number of children killed in Gaza in the past 4 months is now more than the number of children killed in conflicts over the past 4 years around the world. Do you think something like this and seeing those images will change the Biden administration's policy towards Israel, push it to do something different?
It is devastating that there are children being killed, that anyone is being killed. But let's remember that these are victims of Hamas as well. This entire conflict could end tomorrow. Hamas, let's remember, Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, 1,200 Israelis slaughtered, raped. You have 250 of their people held hostage, including 6 Americans that were held hostage. It's absolutely essential that Hamas release the hostages. And at the same time, we are at the table every day because of our close relationship with Israel, working together side by side to make sure we can have a ceasefire with release of the hostages negotiated, while also supporting Israel's absolute right to defend its people and to ensure that this threat is eradicated. Remember, Hamas, after October 7th, said October 7th was the first time, and that there'd be a second, third, and a thousandth time. That is not a tolerable situation that any country should expect to have to live with.
But the argument that it isn't tolerable to have, you know, bombs raining from the sky and killing up to 30,000 people, I mean, that's not Hamas. That is the Israelis who are doing that Gaza.
They're engaged in a war. War is horrific. But there is a way out of the war where Hamas needs to accept the deal that's on the table. Israel and the United States and Hamas representatives and Qatar, they've been negotiating over how we can get to a ceasefire. And Hamas needs to accept that deal and release the hostages and save their own people who they have subjected to this war.
They haven't built shelters for, but
no,
built tunnels instead.
And using as human shields.
See, an American teacher trapped for hours under rubble after her home in Gaza was hit. Her message for President Biden as she watches neighbor after neighbor being buried. That's next. CNN's Nada Bashir shares with us now the story of an American woman in Gaza whom, after barely surviving a strike on her home, has a resounding message for President Biden.
Small but vital pockets of peace above war-torn Gaza. Yet another round of humanitarian airdrops from international donors. Civilians on the brink of famine desperately scramble to see what has arrived today. Yet, amid each delivery, the war continues. More homes destroyed, more people killed. Deborah, an American woman living in central Gaza, says she has lost count of the number of wars she has lived through in the besieged strip. But this time, she almost did not survive. An Israeli strike, she says, left her crushed in the ruins of her home for hours. Rescued and treated without anesthesia, she now wants answers.
I'm not throwing bombs, I'm not shooting anyone. Why did they come and target me? I need an answer for that. Joe Biden, I need an answer. Why are you letting them target Americans in Gaza?
The English teacher says there is nowhere safe left in Gaza. Some of her neighbors being buried as she speaks.
Yes, I could run. I could go back to America. But I would feel like it was not right to do that. I should stand beside them. I should try to help them.
A voice of solidarity with those in Gaza trying to survive the unthinkable. Nada Bashir, CNN.
I mean, what the fuck was that? Tapper, civilians, blackmailing, Netanyahu. Did Netanyahu attack another country? Because last time I checked, Hamas attacked another country. And you guys are fine with it. So, I'm really confused why it's okay to meddle in that election. Why are you picking a side? Here's a once proud general explaining why we're giving money to Iran during a war in Gaza.
You guys are issuing this warning to Iran 2 days after renewing a waiver that unlocked $10 billion in frozen funds. Don't you think Iran is paying more attention to the actions of this administration than the words?
Can't speak for the mullahs or what they're paying attention to or not. Jackie, I would remind that this sanctions waiver is renewed or up for renewal every 3 months. It's a quarterly thing. It's a sanctions package that was actually put in place by the previous administration, by President Trump and his team, that allows for Iraq to be able to work its way off of Iranian energy so that they can keep the lights on. And we're continuing to work with our Iraqi partners about how to do that. But right now, they still are dependent for a lot of energy from coming from Iran. And so we don't want to penalize the Iraqi people for efforts that they're still trying to get to wean off of that. And I would remind everybody, and we've talked about this before, I think 3 months ago we probably talked about this before, none of this money goes to the mullahs. None of this money goes into Tehran. The sanctions relief that is provided actually goes to vendors that provide humanitarian assistance to the Iranian people. So not only do the Iraqi people not suffer because of this, the Iranian people aren't going to suffer because...
How does this even make sense? You're giving Iran, who finances most of the fucking terrorism in the country or in the world, money so they can finance more terrorism? I mean, is that what we're doing? I don't understand why this administration continues, or lefty administrations across the board, continue to go back to the, we're going to finance Iran. We're going to keep financing them. But all it does is get us more and more problems. Am I wrong? We have more and more stuff happening all the time in the world, and we keep giving money to the major fucking player in international terrorism. And somehow, our media doesn't even catch it. They don't catch it at all. Because they're part of it. Here is the emergency air. The U.S. has started building a naval base on the ruins of Gaza. This is imperialism's most naked form. Photograph shows a temporary pier landing site which has been created in order to deliver aid to Gaza. But of course, the left is, you know, hey. They're telling him to support Gaza, and then they start doing it. And yeah, okay. Wisconsin professor. I literally wish I were in Gaza. No exaggeration. Eat with them, travel with them, die with them. The most honorable life death I can think of. I don't think those of the other side understand. Yeah, you'd be murdered, dude. They'd fucking kill you. A Holocaust survivor is coming to speak to my son's 7th grade history class on Monday. Wonderful. What's less than wonderful, though, is the opt-out for this lesson because we understand that all students have different experiences. What does that even mean? Well, what it means is the left is for it. Tim Kaine. Norm MacDonald. What terrifies me is if ISIS were to detonate a nuclear device and kill 50 million Americans. Imagine the backlash against peaceful Muslims. It's a joke. Tim Kaine goes in. Islamophobia has long plagued our nation. It's only gotten worse due to the Gaza war. There's no laws of Islamophobia. People are calling the fuck out the reality that they are killing fucking people, their own people. Guy Benson, a weekly rally at Hostage Square in Tel Aviv draws thousands, including a heartbroken, despaired, scared family friend of Hamas kidnapped victim. This young woman's sister has been held by the terrorists for 62 days. She broke down several times talking about it. This man lost two of his childhood classmates. This person lost their father. This person lost... That's a baby, folks. So then we get into the statistics, and this is where we're losing the thread. These are Oxfam. 23,074 reported deaths in Gaza between 7 October to 7 January. Deaths per day statistic for Afghanistan was Afghanistan, Iraq, blah, 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 was less, Then you get to real numbers, and the actual numbers are 6,779 people have been killed. That's the real numbers. This isn't your made-up lefty. We use the Islamist PLO. We use their numbers. No, it's the real numbers. But our media doesn't go with the real numbers because our media is full of fucking shit. Here is, I can't even believe this question. They alter photos? The White House is altering photos?
Does the White House ever digitally alter photos of the president, vice president, first lady, or secretary before they're released?
Digitally altered? Not that I know of. I would say no. Why would we digitally alter photos? Are you talking about, are you comparing us to the what's going on in the UK?
I'm doing due diligence to ensure that the leader of another country wouldn't alter photos.
Why does the monarch have to do anything with us? No, that is not something that we do here.
Okay. It's like everything is able to be fudged with this administration. Yes, 2024 is nuts, but remember when the press fawned over Kamala Harris wearing Converse as she had just cured cancer? We went through all this stuff. It's what it is. Yellen was brought out to say that I regret saying what I said because I'm a garbage human. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. We are garbage fucking humans. Garbage. Family Dollar and Dollar Tree will close out 1,000 stores. Just think about that for a second. Harris again, make no mistake, President Biden and I intend to cap child care costs $10 a day. We need Congress to act. How? What? When? Where? Why? What the fuck? Biden's approval rating is so fucking low. It's 37.4. Then we find out about the FBI. I've been sitting on this for a couple weeks. Trove of secret FBI files obtained exclusively by The Intercept raised questions about whether the federal agent pursued a larger secret effort to encourage political violence in the run-up to 2020. The FBI documents recording revealed the federal agents at the time put America in danger as the Whitmer plot metastasized. In one instance, the FBI knew that Wolverine Watchmen militia members, would enter the Michigan Capitol with firearms, and agents suspected that one might even have a live grenade, but they didn't stop them. Another time, federal agents intervened when local police officers in Michigan were about to confiscate firearms for two of the FBI targets. The files also raise a question about whether the FBI pursued a larger effort to make sure there was violence, because then it would help the left. Inflation went back up. Media's not covering it. So, for a break here, what do spring breakers think of Biden? Well, Jesse Waters has a segment on it.
But one city's trash is another city's treasure. Fort Lauderdale welcomed college students with open arms. And after Johnny wouldn't stop bothering me to send him down there, after a while, I gave in.
What college you guys go to?
Florida State University.
Michigan State, baby.
Arizona State.
Everybody's loving spring break. What's going on down here?
A lot of drinking. Like dying.
May she rest in peace.
The guy's got to provide liquor.
Looking for a beautiful white girl, beautiful black girl. I would love a Latina.
How have the ladies been treating you guys?
The issue is he smells funny.
I haven't taken a shower since we got here.
I know you stink. I love it.
What's the craziest thing you guys seen down here so far?
A man licked my foot.
This guy got naked in the bar that we were just...
Multiple people were just coming up to us and being like, hey, spit in my mouth, spit in my mouth.
Well, did you do it?
Yeah.
I'll be darned. That's amazing.
Some guy... skinny dipped over there in the ocean. But again, it definitely wasn't me. On God. Well.
This girl that tried to take my girlfriend, we ended up wrestling.
They go in and they end up fighting both of them. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
How woke is your school?
It's a liberal arts school. Very liberal.
Really woke, actually. I feel like we go crazy a lot. Like, we have a lot of fun.
That's not what the question is.
Oh, wait, what? God, Karen, you are so stupid.
What issue facing America is most important to you?
World peace.
Not enough people on this beach. That's the biggest problem in America right now.
People are too sensitive. I don't like racism.
The bouncers need to do a better job because I don't want to walk into a club full of ugly men.
It's 10 o'clock. You gotta go.
What are you talking about? How's Joe Biden doing?
Old as f***. I need a hot president, and I think it should be me.
Look, I'm very young, energetic, and handsome. What the hell am I doing this for?
Joe Biden sucks, dude.
He's raising prices, like, not it.
This old. He's not really doing man.
Take a look around you, Ellen. We're at the threshold of hell.
What has Joe Biden accomplished?
What has he accomplished? Nothing?
That would be correct.
Really? Yay, me!
How's Kamala doing?
Kamala? Is that the colored lady like me? I don't even know who that is. I don't even know who that is.
Kamala Harris? What do you think she does?
Oh, it's a girl.
Harris, dude. She's running the ship from behind the scenes. She's pulling in strings like a puppet, bro.
No, I you're right.
Define inflation.
It's bad.
I was paying $8 for a Big Mac meal a couple of weeks ago. I'm paying $12 for it.
People going broke.
That's not a big thing, okay?
If you were in charge, how would you handle the migrant crisis?
If they're not slaying the day, they could get the out.
We gotta get those illegals sent back home.
Like getting into bars, when like girls get in the bars easier than guys.
So you let the girls in first.
It's the only reason I like being a girl.
A sexist would say.
How important to you is January 6th?
I don't know. I don't pay attention to dates like that. January 6th is very important because my best friend's birthday is January 5th. So that's the best week of the entire year.
I like it. I like it. It's a good day. It's a great day. Because I know who's going to win.
What happens on January 6th?
That's when we vote.
Goodness, y'all.
Bless his heart.
How's Donald Trump doing?
He's a cool motherfucker. Love that guy. He's good stuff.
I love you too, but you're not my type.
You want to say what's up to Jesse Waters?
Hi.
My mom loves you, okay? And that means I love you too.
What's up, Jesse Waters?
Come to spring break.
So the Lincoln Riley Act went in, but of course, not all Democrats were for it. And what I don't understand is, how is this guy winning Georgia?
Let me ask you another question, because we know that one of the ways that Donald Trump and Republicans are hoping to demagogue their way back into, you know, control of the White House and to hold on to control of the Senate, control of the House and gain control of the Senate, is the immigration issue. And they've been truly demagoguing an issue of a Georgia young woman who was killed, a Georgia young nursing student named Lincoln Riley. They've now passed a law called the Lincoln Riley Act. All Republican members and 37 Democrats voted in the House to support the bill. The legislation requires the detention of any migrant who's been accused of burglary or theft. My understanding is that burglary and theft are already illegal. What does this law add to the current existing law? Is it just a messaging bill? Does it do anything or change anything? I will note for our audience that overall crime is down this year across this country. And migrant crime is negligible. Crime by migrants is negligible. What does this law do? Does it do anything?
Let me first of all just say that my heart goes out to this young woman's family. Lincoln Riley did not deserve what happened to her. To answer your question succinctly, this is smoke and mirrors by people who are not serious. We had a bipartisan piece of legislation in front of us. It had a lot of provisions, some provisions that some folks on my side didn't like. But the only way to get comprehensive immigration reform, the only way to address the current crisis on the border in divided government, is on a bipartisan basis. And so rather than demagoguing this tragic death by this young woman, they ought to get serious. And let's pass some bipartisan legislation and deal with the crisis at the border.
That's very interesting. What is this? Breaking DHS. Griff Jenkins, the Haitian man arrested for raping a 15-year-old disabled girl at Migrant Hotel in Massachusetts Wednesday night, came to U.S. via the Biden admin parole program for Haitians. Huh. That's really interesting. Sorry. Here's some more. Here's Chris Hayes talking about it and cherry-picking stats and saying that America's safer now with unfettered illegal immigration.
That Joe Biden is officially the presumptive Democratic nominee for president. His 2024 re-election campaign begins full force. He will be running primarily on his record, right? What he has gotten done for the American people over the last 4 years. And here's the thing. This election's interesting and different. For the first time since 1892, when President Benjamin Harrison faced a rematch against his predecessor, Grover Cleveland, Biden will be running against the man who held the office just before him, the man he beat, the man who didn't want to leave. It sets up one of the most clear-cut apples-to-apples comparisons possible in a presidential election, right? Usually one of the people is an incumbent, the other is just sort of like talking about what they would do. They don't have a record. But here, in this case, you got two records to compare. How is the country doing when Donald Trump was president, as he catastrophically bungled the response to a once-in-a-century pandemic and then left in disgrace, having fomented an unsuccessful coup and getting impeached for it? And how are things now, 4 years later, under this president, Joe Biden? There is quite a story to tell about the general trajectory of American life in the last 4 years. And we just so happen to have some visual aids to help tell that story. We're going to show you some charts. And here's the thing about the charts, all right? Generally, you want the good stuff to go up and the bad stuff to come down, okay? Pretty simple. You want to see good stuff go up, bad stuff come down. So this is how that looks. Let's just start with GDP, gross domestic product. That is the measure and the value of all goods and services produced in the United States, right? It's the size of the U.S. economy. And like the rest of the world, We saw a significant drop. See when it goes down there, the constriction, that in GDP in 2020. That was the pandemic. That was under Donald Trump's watch. But just look at the recovery in the 4 years since. Look at that. Go up. In fact, the U.S. had the strongest recovery of all of its peers. Every country faced similar headwinds and challenges. Last year, our economy grew faster than any other nation in the G7. And when you zoom in a little further, now showing only the Biden years, it's essentially a straight line going up. That was not foreordained. A lot of could have gone wrong. It's hard to pick yourself back up from a once-in-a-century pandemic and the disruptions. We've seen this growth now reflected in the stock market. Again, start low, go high, right? 4 years ago, Dow plunged. Remember that? Recording its worst ever drop in a single day on March 16th, 2020, almost exactly 4 years ago, under President Donald Trump. He was obsessed with the stock market. 4 years later, not only is it back on track, it hit an all-time record high at the end of last month. Once again, over the past year, right? From here to there, getting better. Now, there's a bunch of reasons for this really remarkable economic performance and growth in this era, the Biden era, the last few years. Jobs have really bounced back. Labor force participation rate, that's the percentage of people who are in the labor force, really increasing steadily from the COVID era lows, right? It hit lows during the pandemic, and then it goes up. New business applications. This is people starting businesses, which is, you know, the American dream. In 2023 alone, Americans filed 5.5 million new business applications. That was a record high for the year. In fact, that was the third year in a row of record-breaking applications for a total of 16 million over the first 3 years of the Biden administration. Starts down here, goes up. Manufacturing is also booming thanks to a flurry of Biden-signed legislation. More and more goods being produced in America again, bringing good-paying manufacturing jobs back into the U.S. See how that goes? Hospitality jobs in particular have bounced back after plummeting after the pandemic. Again, not a given the industry would recover fully post-COVID. You see it go down here. But travel's back. We can see from the number of passengers flying on U.S. airlines. This is the summer of 2020, right? In the depths, up to now July 2023. Across the board, and this is key, wages are rising faster than inflation. I mean, wages rising in real terms, okay? Workers now make an average of more than $34 an hour. Earnings are outpacing inflation, crucially. That means there is more money in Americans' pockets to spend. Disposable personal income. This is one of the most important charts here. Took a huge hit when COVID support ended and inflation spiked. It was really bad on people's balance sheets. Now it's on the right track. This is the last 2 years, having significantly increased in the last 2 years from down here to up there. Another thing we're doing in the last 4 years, we're producing more of our own energy here in the US. Crude oil production, basically no one in America knows this, so listen closely. Crude oil production under Democratic President Joe Biden broke records last year. It is outpacing projections so far in 2024. In fact, we're producing right now more oil than any other nation ever has at any time ever. Now, you might say, as I do when I say that sentence, from a climate perspective, not great, which true, but crucially also, renewable power is booming. Renewable power generation is also up amid President Biden's $370 billion investment in clean energy through the Inflation Reduction Act. Inflation Reduction Act, remember that? Remember they named it that? Not necessarily because it was an inflation bill, but because of this chart. Inflation, this is the whole story of the last 4 years in some way. It's the reason, I think, that Joe Biden's faced political headwinds. This is also the story in every other country on earth. Inflation has had a rocky ride since the pandemic and the massive supply chain interruptions it brought. The Consumer Price Index, that's the measurement, right? Measurement that changed the average price of goods and services, hit 9% in the summer of 2022 right there. And that was bad. It caused severe financial strain for people. And crucially, this was a global phenomenon. Happened basically everywhere. But look at this, since then, right? It has come way down. It's now hovering at 3%. Again, this was not guaranteed. If you go read the economic press back here, people are like, we're going to need a recession, or it's going to keep going up forever, or we're screwed, or we're walking to catastrophe. None of that happened. It has come down to 3%. And like economic growth, this is better than basically any of our peer countries. They would all trade places to be us. The unemployment rate has also dropped massively after hitting an unprecedented spike of nearly 15% in 2020, right? The same story in the chart. Bad things happen in 2020, and then they get better after Donald Trump leaves office. Over the past couple of years of the Biden presidency, unemployment has actually been hovering below 4% for an unprecedentedly long period of time. In the past year, amid all these economic improvements, mortgage rates, which have risen quite a bit as the Federal Reserve hiked rates, have started coming down as well, which is welcome. We're seeing gas prices drop. Remember this story from a spike at nearly $5 per gallon in the summer of 2022, people going around putting on their Joe Biden stickers on gas pumps, saying, I did that. You don't see that so much anymore because we're now down to a little over $3 per gallon. They start up here, they go down there. And finally, and this is the one conservatives love to get wrong, one we're obsessed with here on the show, there has been a big decrease in violent crime under President Biden. 2020 was one of the most dangerous years in America in a decade under Donald Trump. Violent crime spiked around the country. It spiked in both urban and rural areas. But in every year of the Biden administration, violent crime has come down. In fact, according to the latest estimates, 2023 is on track to have one of the lowest violent crime rates in half a century. So compared to 4 years ago, when Donald Trump was president, these are just the facts, okay? The country is safer. It is more prosperous. It is more energy independent. There are more people working and making higher wages, more people starting new businesses, more people working in manufacturing. The last year of the last president's term, of Donald Trump's term, was a nightmare. And because it was a nightmare, it's easy to block out. But look how far the country's come. This is what has been achieved under President Joe Biden. And it is the pitch you can expect him to be making to voters all this year.
It's fucking... it's almost criminal how much they spin shit. And yet, if Trump wins, this is all going to flip on its head. It's illegal immigration. Be front page news again. We'll be losing our shit over it. Totally. House may refer some of these assholes for prosecution for fucking perjury, fraud, the whole nine yards. It'll never happen. But it was really neat to see that up because that was the biggest freaking almost Pravda-esque thing I've seen in my 56 years. And I've been through Benghazi and the Clinton stuff. This shit's out of control. Federal agents are secretly collaborating with gaming companies to monitor and fight domestic extremism. So they're going to have people in there rooting around in people's games as they play. Because all these gamers are just, oh my God, there's so many. Chicago is going to kick everybody out of their homeless shelters. And I just want to make sure we understood that, that's a sanctuary city. This is WAPO, get rid of Biden, or Harris. Soros-backed prosecutor, remember this lady? Yeah. Rachel Pollins had to resign because she is about to get dick slapped. I'm pretty sure she has a dick. Border Patrol Union. It isn't Biden's age that concerns us. Not all 80-year-olds are equal. But when he instantly gets hyper-focused while exhibiting angry bursts of energy during a debate or a State of the Union, then the next day transports back to a state of extreme bumbling and confusion, something ain't right. Woo! No, it's not. Mm-mm. It is not right at all, boys and girls. The media is trying so fucking hard. So I'm going to play a block here because they're just really good sound bites. We're going to have the Fannie Willis stuff that they're still butthurt over because the judge went off on Willis and they're going to say it's, it's sexism, racism, xenophobia, trans homo, slab, whatever the fuck. Some kind of phobia. And simultaneously, I'm going to pair it with the CNN piece that the right doesn't care about disinformation. The right doesn't care about disinformation as they're putting out disinformation.
Trump's lawyers are going to have to defend him in a court of law, maybe not this year, based on the facts and the law. But until then, they have two goals. The first is to delay all four of his criminal trials. The other is to sow distrust in the criminal justice system. And what we've seen down in Fulton County over the past few months has helped him with both of those goals. Anyone who says that this is a win for Fani Willis, it's a technical victory, but I would argue this helps the Trump team.
Yeah.
This absolutely gives them ammunition to try to attack her credibility and taint their own version of the jury pool.
This has nothing to do with, I mean, as Fani Willis said, I'm not the one on trial. Mm-hmm. Trump and these co-defendants are on trial, but the judge just goes after Fani Willis and Nathan Wade, as if they were on trial.
Absolutely. A number of these statements sort of toe the line of, is this a credibility finding, or are you taking a pot shot at the prosecutor?
Trump is going to run wild with this. He's already been doing it out on the campaign trail at these rallies, talking about Fani Willis and Nathan Wade.
Yeah, he's obsessed
it
with Fani
almost
Willis.
Sounds like Strzok and Lisa Page. It's the
right.
same
it's
thing.
It's very, very similar. I see how Donald Trump's team is going to take advantage of it. Donald Trump is going to repeat some of these lines in rallies. Okay. And, you know, I'm getting a lot of pushback already online for saying that, you know, Donald Trump is going to use this and his supporters are going to eat this up. But this is what I've seen for the last several years. Donald Trump takes some of these nuggets of truth.
Yeah, who pushed back on that?
Exactly. Well, on the internet. Well, so, you know, but Donald takes a nugget of truth and fact from this report and then will blow it up, and his people will believe him. And not just his people, he will be able to reach other people by using this, because that is the tactic he has used since 2016.
There's a part of me that wonders, you know, it just feels kind of, sickening to the stomach that their personal life got thrown into all of this. And now the judge has come out and said, well, you know, tremendous lapse in judgment and so on. And it's going to damage this case. Maybe I'm wrong here, but I can hear some of our viewers at home saying, why do I know more about the personal life of Fani Willis and Nathan Wade than I do about the details of this case of Donald Trump and these alleged co-conspirators trying to overturn election results in Georgia?
If there's any one thing that Donald J. Trump has been more successful at than any in the last 5 years, it's taking a fact that is a kernel of legal truth to it, spinning it, putting it out to the people, getting it like chum in the water, and confusing the public.
Trump's getting help. It's not just that they're the...
You know, they tried to steal an election.
Right.
The former president of the United States of America and his little friends, as my mother would say, tried to steal an election. And the DA, Fani Willis, is seeking to hold them accountable.
Right.
And because she sought that accountability, they, the former president and his little friends, allies, Ashley Merchant, the attorney for one of those individuals, they then tried to distract us with salacious gossip.
Right.
Because that is what this is, because there, if there were facts, we would have found them. And it worked so much so that very well-meaning people who are just, who know a lot, who lots of very smart lawyers in this country are walking around and sitting up on television being like, well, I don't know if Fani Willis could stay on this case. This was a distraction.
Right. Alvin Bragg doesn't have that problem in New York.
But this was a distraction because they haven't tried to distract him with this.
Like, they don't have anything to hang on Alvin Bragg's head.
They can make it up.
York.
They didn't have anything about Fani Willis. So, and I'm so animated about this. I'm sorry. I'm very animated about this because this is... We all have a duty, I think, to remind people about what this is really about. And frankly, if Fani Willis was a man named Frank, I don't believe that they would have been able to distract us with the salacious gossip about, oh, well, Frank hired Susie so that Frank could financially benefit from Susie being on the case.
So is there a difference between Republicans and Democrats in how they view this kind of material?
Yeah, I mean, I think Republicans these days often dispute the whole idea that disinformation is a meaningful category. I think if you talk to many Republicans, and we see this in the weaponization of government hearings that Jim Jordan is running, the state attorneys general who are suing tech companies over this, that what you hear a lot from Republicans is, you know, disinformation is something that a concept that Democrats created so that they could partner with government and academia to pressure tech companies to silence conservative voices. And so you have a lot of Republican political operatives who are very interested in tracking what people are saying online, but they don't really buy the idea that this is a meaningful category.
How do they square that when, I mean, if somebody were to make a robocall of Donald Trump, I mean, they just don't see that as a problem?
Like, they think that the term disinformation is a sort of tool that Democrats use, you know, to silence conservatives and also sort of as an excuse post-2016 to evade.
To further elaborate my point, here is Jake Tapper going after Aaron Rodgers, saying that he, a guy from Berkeley, was saying Sandy Hook was fake.
Update to the exclusive reporting we brought to you yesterday about one of RFK Jr.'s vice presidential prospects, Aaron Rodgers. You might remember we reported on the unhinged conspiracy theories that New York Jets quarterback Aaron Rodgers has shared in private that the 2012 very real Sandy Hook school shooting was not real, that it was a fake, despite the fact that 20 children and 6 adults were murdered that day. Now, these comments, of course, are troubling, but they're especially important because he's on Robert Kennedy Jr.'s shortlist for vice president. Normally, who cares what a quarterback says in private conversation? Yesterday on his ESPN show, Pat McAfee said that Rodgers was apparently at a retreat in Costa Rica taking the psychedelic drug ayahuasca when the news broke about his being on the shortlist for vice president for RFK Jr. Yesterday here on The Lead, we reported that Aaron Rodgers had shared these frankly disturbing views about the Sandy Hook shooting not being real. He shared them 11 years ago with CNN's Pamela Brown. She was covering the Kentucky Derby for CNN in 2013 and met him there. CNN, I have also spoken to another person, one who would like to remain anonymous in order to avoid harassment, who also had a similar encounter with Aaron Rodgers, saying that Rodgers claimed that, quote, Sandy Hook never happened, all those children never existed, they're all actors, unquote. When asked about the grieving parents, whom I met, and their grief is real, the source says that Rodgers said, quote, they're all making it up, they're all actors, unquote. Now, today, Aaron Rodgers is responding to our story, kind of. He does not deny saying what we reported he said, but he, or a representative for him, tweeted the following statement, quote, as I'm on the record saying in the past, what happened in Sandy Hook was an absolute tragedy. I am not and have never been of the opinion that the events did not take place. Again, I hope that we learn from this and other tragedies to identify the signs that would allow us to prevent unnecessary loss of life. My thoughts and prayers continue to remain with the families affected, along with the entire Sandy Hook community, unquote. Again, you know, if you read that statement, Rodgers does not deny those comments that he made to Pamela Brown and to the other source. Last night on Fox, RFK Jr. was asked about Aaron Rodgers.
I really like Aaron because, you know, our appeal is to young people. Aaron Rodgers is battle-tested. He's stood up. He's been hammered by the press, stood up for things we believed in. I like that part of his character. He's a critical thinker.
Critical thinker is now obviously what we're calling conspiracy theorists. Kennedy was not in that interview, perhaps not surprisingly, asked about the comments that we reported Aaron Rodgers made to Pamela Brown and someone else about Sandy Hook not having actually happened. Today, a spokesperson for RFK Jr.'s campaign did address those comments, responding to CNN in a statement saying, quote, Mr. Kennedy believes the Sandy Hook shooting was a horrific tragedy. The 20 children and 6 adults that died December 14, 2012, brought the entire country together in grief. Let us honor their memory. This is where we are as a nation. We have actually as a subject for debate whether or not a vice presidential prospect thinks a massive shooting actually happened. Should RFK Jr. select Aaron Rodgers as his running mate, again, someone he describes as a battle-tested critical thinker, it might cost him. Mediaite is reporting the donors have voiced their discontent directly with the campaign, pledging to withdraw their support from Kennedy if he chooses Rodgers in particular. RFK Jr. is expected to announce his pick on March 26.
Good standards there, Jake Tapper, you fucking twat. So we're going to end with a 10-minute segment on a Army unit. It's really freaking astounding what this found. We're talking over units face overwork, higher suicide rates. It was just a fucking hot mess. This is by the military.com. But before we hit that, Boom. Remember last podcast we had the membership person saw a dude in the female locker? Yeah, they revoked her membership. Dude shaving is still good to go. So military segment, and we're going to go into a TikTok in Tinda. TT, T-Square.
This story started for us in the summer of 2022 when we requested forms detailing all of the Army's non-combat deaths from Army Human Resources Command. What we found ultimately was that holders of the 19-kilo MOS, which is enlisted tank crew members, had a suicide rate nearly three times higher than the rest of the Army between 2019 and 2021. Tankers, in fact, had the highest suicide rate of any large career field. We also found that members of armored brigade combat teams, regardless of their MOS, were more than twice as likely than other members of the active duty force to kill themselves. And we also found that among the service's ABCTs, these deaths were fairly evenly distributed. There were no obvious outliers. Every single Army tank brigade, in fact, had a higher suicide rate during that three-year window than the Army-wide average. So we went to suicide experts, we went to tank community experts, and we started going to the soldiers themselves to ask, why might this be the case? What do we need to be looking into? The answer we got back from almost all of them was how hard the Army's tank units have been working for the past 10 years. The roots of this crisis run pretty deep. Beginning in the early 2010s, the Army closed many of its overseas bases in Germany and Korea that included forward-stationed armor brigades. The idea behind those original basing decisions was to have those units on hand in theater to deter enemy aggression. But even as the funding to keep them there dried up, the need for it didn't. As these requirements mounted on the Army's tank brigades, that meant that their time at home between deployments started to shrink as well. Eventually, most of them settled into a cycle where they would spend 9 months abroad, 18 months at home, and then 9 months abroad again. As the pace intensified, however, the quality of those 18 months at home started to decrease. They would have to go to combat training centers and complete six-week rotations there. To go to a CTC rotation, you've got to qualify at a brigade training event. Then you have battalion events, company events, platoon events. You've got to qualify your individual tank and Bradley crews. And the whole way, you have to take these vehicles out into the field to meet these training benchmarks. And when they do that, they're going to break. The broken vehicles and the stress from that was compounded by constant backlogs on maintenance parts and shrinkage of the maintenance force associated with some reforms to force structure. All of these things compounded themselves into a cycle where these tank brigades were spending increasingly less time with their families, even when they were at home, despite the fact that none of them were really fighting overseas anymore. One of the mental health experts with whom I spoke, Dr. Craig Bryan of Ohio State University, he's a former Air Force psychologist, and he wrote a 2022 book called Rethinking Suicide. In it, Bryan is one of the experts on the leading edge of a new wave of suicide research that theorizes everybody is at risk of suicide if they reach a certain stress level. And daily stress and hassles in somebody's personal or professional life can bring them closer to that threshold where they are at risk of suicide. I spoke with Brian extensively for this story, and he said that in the military specifically, as a member of the Pentagon Suicide Prevention Committee, He has found that operational tempo, or those deployments and those long, unpredictable working hours, are significant sources of daily stress for soldiers, and even more so for members of armored brigade combat teams. The way he put it was that it's like death by a thousand paper cuts for these soldiers. They are put at a slightly greater risk of suicide with each daily hassle they experience. It reduces their resilience for when something bigger may go wrong in their lives, such as finances, such as a personal relationship. Ultimately, it's a complex phenomenon, suicide. It's highly dependent on an individual, their support system, their beliefs, their access to care, their access to lethal means, and more. But you have a community of soldiers that is collectively closer to the brink because of a combination of policy and operational decisions made over the past 10 years by the Army, the Defense Department, and Congress. What experts, even the Army's own, told me is that systemic suicide risk associated with being part of a specific unit is a new concept for them to address. The Army has long understood that particular career fields may be at a higher risk of suicide. However, research such as Craig Bryan's is new to the scene. And the idea of systemic suicide risk based on the daily life of a certain type of unit, that's not something that the Army's existing suicide prevention program is geared to account for. Army suicide prevention right now is primarily focused on individuals and small units, tailored to detect and treat mental illness, to intervene when there's crises, and to try to instill individual resiliency in service members. And the program also exists at the installation level, where, say, the commander of Fort Carson has lead over all the resources there and is ultimately responsible for working to prevent suicides there. The problem, of course, is that your 11 armored brigade combat teams are scattered across multiple installations. They're not always at home at their installations, and they are all subject to the same systemic stress raisers that may differ from other units at their post. Meanwhile, there are some things happening outside the suicide prevention world that hold some promise. The Army has taken a few steps to reduce operational tempo by changing the Korea deployment from tanks to striker brigades. They've also changed the Kuwait deployment to National Guard armor brigades. But even so, the Iron Knight Battalion at Fort Carson is about to deploy for another 9 months or 8 months after barely having 15, 16 months at home since their last year of deployment. They're still on the treadmill. That said, they're trying to find ways to reduce maintenance strains at some armor-heavy installations. For Cavazos, Texas, home of the 1st Cavalry Division, which is one of the heaviest in the Army, they're going to establish a new company commander and first sergeant course and establish a new battalion executive officer course that is geared partially to helping these leaders understand how to run maintenance programs without running their soldiers into the ground. We found that 1st Battalion, 66th Armor Regiment, the Iron Knight Battalion, the oldest tank battalion in the Army, it proudly claims, at Fort Carson, Colorado, experienced 6 suicides in a 14-month span in 2020 and 2021. The story's narrative really centers around the Iron Knights, and I was fortunate that many current and former members of the unit trusted me to tell the story of how those months unfolded.
Looking back at that, you know, winter of 2020, it was like surviving. That's what it was. It was surviving. I couldn't really take a break being a company's senior medic, and so there was a lot of locking stuff away and avoidance during that time for a lot of people.
So I have PTSD, And I kind of denied that I had it for a very long time. And that's actually what I'm being medically retired for right now, is PTSD. One of the symptoms that bothers me the most is I can't answer phone calls unless I know what they're about. So like a friend calls me, a parent calls me, I cannot answer them. I'll like text them and say I'm in an appointment or something like that. Because of those years of 2020 and 2021 of being called to tell me that somebody has killed themselves or somebody's died. That's a major problem of mine, is I have such anxiety about answering the phone call because I just assume that somebody's dead.
We're not sure yet what's going to happen yet as a result of our reporting. We do know, however, that members of Congress have requested similar data in the past because they've wanted the kinds of insights that we were able to put together for this project. Readers who want to know more about how we pulled it off can read the pieces, there's three of them, on armytimes.com. And stick with us, viewers. We're going to keep following this and keep everything in the membrane.
Okay, going through a lot of different things on YouTube and been hitting some really interesting statistics. Partly because, you know, I'm a father. I want my son to have a wife and have a baby girl. I want a baby girl bad. It's not happening. I forget the damn thing's here. I got it and I forget to even put it. I need to like mount it over here. It's like I'm popping. That's actually a good idea. Put that sucker right over here on the wall. Let's have a longer cord. And then stick that fucker like right here. And then I'd actually use it a lot more. But I don't use it because I forget it's there. I don't remember which... What is it? Ding, ding, ding. Yeah, that's the one I'm looking for. So we go through these trends. And the reason why we do this is that I saw the following video.
So, I went out on a Tinder date the other day. Starts good. Dinner's good. We even decide to go watch a movie at his house after. And a little sexy time happens. We're not against sexy time. We like sexy time. So, sexy time usually makes you hungry. And we decide to get tacos. So, I hop in the car and I look over at homeboy who's on his phone. I'm thinking he's gonna pick a slow jam for us to go get our munch on. And no, he's got Tinder open and he's matching with chicks and responding to girls he's already matched with. I'm no expert, but I kind of think you should wait till a girl you've just hooked up with, one, leaves your house, two, leaves your car before you start scouting out your next conquest.
So, it made me wonder what that would be like. Now, once again, I'm happily married. I am not looking for dates. I don't want open relationships. I'm not into any of the cool things that people are doing right now. I've done a lot of research lately just because it's big and it's in the political sphere. So, well, not political, but media sphere, that I went and started looking at all this shit, and it just fucking scares the shit out of me. I could never do it. There's just... not made for it. But you get into these stats and it's fucking crazy. Tinder has over 75 million monthly active users. 75.8 of them are men. Only 24% are women. 95% of Tinder matches meet in person between 2 and 7 days after matching. Tinder is approximately 10.9 million subscribers. The reality is that's not true. None of what that just said is true, because it's not. It's mostly women picking a small percentage, so most guys don't even get a match. This is their pie chart. Divorced, widowed is 3%. In a relationship, 12%, and that's because they are doing open. Married, 30%. Single. Age range, 38% to 24. 16 should not be on Tinder, but, you know, what do I know? 25 to 34 is 45. Us old fuckers, 1%. 76% of them live in an urban area. And that's the deal breaker right there. That's the deal breaker right there. So what are you saying? 76% live in a city. Well, then they're liberals. So if you're conservative or not, or like me, non-liberal, or my son, who's an libertarian, you're not getting a fucking date. It's Moonbat City. In 2022, Tinder had 64 million downloads, slightly less than 67 during 2021, because that was the frickin' COVID. So that means married people were in COVID doing their thing. I don't think I have this stat up. Sorry, folks. No, nope, that's not what I wanted. That's not it. That's revenue. They started in 15 with 300,000. Now they're up to 10.9. The biggest influx was 2019, 20, and 21. That's when it blew up. Their revenue is in fucking sane. They made $1.79 billion fucking dollars. 27.6 market share of dating apps. If you look at other apps, Bumble, Grindr's a gay one, so it's under other. I thought Grindr was for sandwiches. I swear to God, I saw an ad and I clicked it and I realized I saw penis. I don't know shit. I'm literally like the old lady in that commercial. This is not any of this works because I thought it was for sandwiches. I swear to God, I did. Over 30 million matches are made on Tinder every fucking day, but that doesn't mean they're doing anything. This number remains despite the fact that an average match rate for Tinder users is only 1.63. 1% chance. Men are more likely to swipe right than women. Men swipe 46% of the time on average, while women swipe right only 14% of the time. This disparity is further exaggerated by the fact that there are more men on Tinder. Only 7% of men send a message after matching a Tinder. That is compared to 21% by females. Male to female ratio is 75% male to 24.2 female. However, not all countries have a severe disparity. For instance, the male to female ratio in India is 62-38. Europe is 50-50. Is Tinder losing popularity? Tinder download dropped by 5% over time. While the decrease might not be significant, it becomes significant when you consider massive growth, 15 to 20, we talked about. They get subscriptions, super likes, boosts. Then you go over to some more crazy fucking stats that go with this. The average users. This one is very interesting. What are the most right swipe professions? So for men, it's pilot, entrepreneur, firefighter, doctor, TV, radio personality, teacher, engineer, model, paramedic, and college student. For women, physical therapist, because they're good with their hands. I guess that's what they're going with. Interior designer, founder, PR communication, teacher, college student, speech language pathologist, pharmacist, social media management, or model. Men have more one-night stands. Let's see if I can read this fucking thing. At least one, 9%. Female or green, none. 40% of men don't. But overall, I prefer not to say one, 22.7%. So this is really not a good pie chart. If you add this up, it's 10, 19, 20, 40. Yeah, okay, some more over here. 22% said no and 40% said yeah. Tinder matching behavior. Portion match on each right swipe could change according to several variables such as shared interest, location, and age. These elements are taken into account by Tinder's algorithm when choosing. Users who match each other have a set amount of time to message before the match expires. The average amount of time between matching and messaging is 2.5 days. The messaging behavior, send 10 messages per match. That's their thing. Profile preferences. On Tinder, several variables such as height, career, and degree affect choices. And a dating survey. Tinder trends and change over time. Blah, blah, blah. Fucking blah with periods of blah, 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 blah. So that's our Tinder thing, which just scares the living shit out of me. I don't know how you find love that way. I think you'd have more chance going to Whole Foods and meeting somebody in the produce aisle. So we're going to watch this girl's little journey because all she does is post videos of her failed Tinder dates.
Okay, I've got another one for you. And this time it's not my bad date. It was one that I witnessed. So I went and grabbed drinks with a couple coworkers the other day. And these people to the side of me look like they're on a first date, getting to know each other. This guy has a bag with him. And so they're doing the small talk thing. She's like, oh, like, did you just get done at the gym? Like, why do you have this bag? And he dead ass says, in case this date goes well, I wanted to be prepared to spend the night. First of all, if you're going to be weird enough to do that, leave it in the car. Don't bring it into the bar with you. Second of all, that's just, that gives me like serial killer vibes. He never opened the bag. Obviously, the last date did not go so well. But after a little self-discovery and thinking about how that all played out, I've decided that I'm a hopeless romantic who is also horny. So I'm going to keep putting myself out there and kiss a couple frogs to see if I can find my hopeless romantic counterpart who's also horny. And so I've got another date next week with a commercial pilot. Hopefully, fingers crossed, it goes better than last time. And if not, I'm sure you'll hear about it either way.
The dating apps have not been going very well for me. So I think it's time to move from the swiping to the real world. And I feel like a good place to do that would be Home Depot, because there are already men there, ton of them, looking to do DIY projects. And maybe a couple of them are looking to upgrade from DIY to a teamwork activity. My best friend came to visit me this past weekend, and we decided to go downtown, get all gussied up, have a good time. And we went to a few bars to start, and eventually this guy kind of tried to attach himself to us. He was like forcibly trying to get us drinks. We were trying to be polite at first, like, no thank you, we're not interested. He didn't really accept that answer, so he just kept trying to buy us drinks. And so eventually we looked at each other and we were like, let's bar hop and get out of here. But he wound up just following us wherever we went. But the last bar we went to, the bartender actually noticed that we were uncomfortable and gave us shots of water and was like, pretend it's vodka, it's from that guy. But I've never had a bartender do that, and it made me feel really comfortable. And so if you're a bartender...
So my best friend and I were watching Fear Factor last night, and we got to thinking, what if you have to submit your fears when you apply to be on the show? Like, I'm afraid of dark, deep water, or I don't like to eat gross stuff, or heights really freak me out. Because if that's the case, I'm afraid of swimming around in a tub of red wine looking for $100 bills. I'm afraid of...
So and I last went one. On a date with the pilot.
There we go.
We went to a bar downtown, and when I get there, he is playing pool with another woman. He kind of makes it seem like it might be a sister or a cousin or someone who's in town to visit. So he goes to the bathroom eventually, and I ask her how they know each other, and she says that they met on Tinder and that she's on a Tinder date. So I guess he was trying to kill two very beautiful birds with one stone. So when he gets back from the bathroom, I took her to the bar, bought her a shot, and dipped on out of there. I guess we have to kiss a couple more frogs.
So that was her story. And I watched show after show after show after show on this subject because the algorithm went bonkers on YouTube. And it basically came down to women want that pilot. They want 6 figures, 6'2", 20-inch cock. I mean, they are so particular on who they date. They only get less than 1% of men on Tinder pop up, and then they don't like the guy because he's a what's the word I'm looking for? Personality-less fucking droid. And they never take the guy who's blue-collar, make $40,000, but is going to love the fuck out of him and bust his ass the rest of his life to take care of him. They don't see that guy. Because they believe, and we're talking, these are women that are fucking fat as shit, ugly as my asshole. They're not attractive women. They, wildebeest, believe they deserve 6 figures, a dude that's statuesque, and I get everything I ever want. And I was just shocked. It was another one of those moments that I texted my son and I said, I'm so sorry. I kept getting on him. Go out and find a girl, dude. Do something. But the only girl he's ran into is a palomore who is looking for a unicorn. She just wanted somebody to fuck on the side because she was already living with somebody else. But she didn't tell him that until the end of the date after she already tongue-fucked him. And I couldn't even handle this stuff. There's no fucking way I could live in the modern world. I just couldn't. There's just no freaking way. I mean, I would not hook up a date with somebody I found online. Then the girl like that, hey, it's cool. She's horny and shit. But you know what? If you're fucking randos on Tinder and putting it on TikTok, I still believe in communicable diseases. So one thing about this open relationship, I don't understand how they do that. If everybody's fucking everybody and you're just randomly fucking people, don't you get diseases? Isn't there a possibility to get some diseases? I don't know. It just doesn't sound like a really safe thing to do. I mean, we are in the world of AIDS. People don't talk about it anymore. But people have AIDS, chlamydia, syphilis, gonorrhea. I just don't get it. I just don't get any of it. But I don't have to, thank God, because I'm married. Because good Lord, it's just a hellscape out there. So we're going to do This Is America. We haven't done it forever. Here's the White House lying about the Hearst stuff and attacking a federal prosecutor. I just want to make sure we capture that moment because when Trump did that, that was beneath the office. Rendering the freaking Constitution and shredding it and wiping his ass. And then we have just a quick thing, and I'll go to the slides really quick. This is AOC getting mad that people on CNN said that Omar is a recruiting tool for Hamas. And nobody stopped it, even the lefties, because it's factual. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now. Look what I'm whipping now. This is America. Don't catch you slipping now. Don't catch you slipping now.
This is America.
It is notable that in his opening statement, which is a little bit over 4 pages long, Robert Hearst spends almost 2 pages talking about the issue of the president's memory and why he did include that. I have not seen the transcript of the president's testimony. You said it's been released by the Justice Department to Congress, so perhaps we all will see some of it. Evan Perez has seen some of it. His reporting this morning on the issue. And again, this is something that President Biden himself took issue with in the original report, bringing up his memory of the death of his son, Beau. This is a quote from Evans' reporting. The transcript shows that the president brought up his son amid a broader discussion about his handling of sensitive documents as he mulled his future after leaving public office after 5 decades. Asked where he kept papers that he was working on, Biden began a story framing the context as the 2017-2018 era. The president brought up his son, Beau, who he said had encouraged him to remain politically engaged. Remember in this time frame, my son is either deployed or is dying, Biden said, according to the transcript. The president brought up his son's death, and he remembered the month and day. What month did Beau die? Oh, God, May 30th. Several people in the room interjected to remind him that his son died in 2015, not the 2017 to 2018 time frame. Again, so this is more context about how the death of his son ever became an issue. It wasn't as if, I'm not mistaken, he wasn't asked about the death of his son by the special counsel, was he?
The president was in fact asked about his work on his book about his son's passing, about his work after his vice presidency on the Biden Cancer Initiative, something that was so deeply motivated by Beau's illness and passing. These are deeply personal and emotional issues for the president, and he's talked openly about those to the American people for years about how he overcame that grief and how he worked through it and how he hoped to find purpose beyond this grief. And that was what he was being asked about. And so anybody who has even a familiarity with the president understands the personal nature of this, and that he would talk about his son Beau and the impact that he had on the work that he was pursuing after his vice presidency on the book and on the cancer work. And I think that the American people can see clearly that the president doesn't need a reminder as to when his son died. He says right there, May 30th, this is something that the president carries with him every single day, the memory of losing his son. Families across this country understand the power of loss and grief and the way that that impacts someone. And this is a president who's taken that loss and grief and turned it into purpose. And I think it just goes to show again how outrageous it was for that to even be included in this report. And don't take just my word for it. Former Attorney General, former Deputy Attorney General, former Justice Department prosecutors, senior officials, all came out in the aftermath of this report and said, this is totally inappropriate.
No, she's a Democrat. They're going to vote for Biden. I'm not surprised about that. I am surprised that in the year of our Lord, 2024, there is a public relations agent for Hamas sitting in the United States Congress. The
fucking classic shit. So this wraps up another episode of Flyover Politic Podcast. Share it with your family and friends. Go to Flyover Politic with K on SoundCloud, Rumble 482467. Email the show at foppodcast@gmail.com. foppodcast@gmail.com. Next show will be... let me get the right calendar app up. Let's go 20 March, year of our Lord, 2024. Until then, disconnect from all your devices. Don't give the yes. Tune into the next show. As always, thanks for listening. Take care.